From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Mike Flynn has cut a deal and is cooperating with Bob Mueller's investigation. Flynn says a very senior Trump transition team member directed him to speak with the Russian ambassador last December. He's pleading guilty to lying to the FBI about that. What else will Flynn tell prosecutors about Trump and his team? Susan Hennessy from Brookings will tell us what to watch for. The Republican tax bill is on the brink of passage through the Senate, and therefore very likely to become law. We'll discuss what that means for the American economy and for the 2018 elections. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Trump is in a spat with the British Prime Minister, the North Koreans launched their most impressive missile yet, and the Secretary of State might get fired. Plus, with Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose gone, Washington Post culture critic Alyssa Rosenberg will join us to discuss the sex harassment problem in morning television and Congress. It's all coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. As we go to tape on Friday, it sure looks like Senate Republicans are going to get this tax bill done. They've been putting together last-minute deals to win over Republican senators, adding in a tax break here and there. But the bill hasn't changed that much. It would sharply cut business income taxes. Most individuals would also get tax cuts in 2018, but those would fade away over time, either eaten by inflation or scheduled to expire within the next 10 years. As a result, most taxpayers would face a tax increase by 2027, unless Congress acts to cut taxes again. The Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation says the bill would likely grow the economy a little bit, not enough to wholly offset the $1.4 trillion it would add to the federal debt, but enough to offset maybe a third. Gene, I want to start with you. Some Republicans have been saying they don't think that Joint Committee analysis is optimistic enough. They say this tax plan will grow the economy a lot. But do you think the committee's right that this plan will grow the economy even a little bit?
I thought the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is the official score, I think they've been highly pressured, and I think they leaned in and were as optimistic as possible. If you look at the other major score people look to, the Center on Tax Policy, they thought there'd be about a $1.2 trillion hole. But Josh, as I think you know, University of Chicago did a survey of 42 top economists. There wasn't one single person who thought that this tax would pay for itself. Virtually all but one thought it would blow a huge hole in the debt and deficit. So, you know, it's very strange for people to be taking on the official scorekeeper. We can argue like you argue with the ref, but you usually accept the ref, and there's never been this type of challenge. So I think this was very aggressive, and I think the idea they'll blow a $1 trillion hole in the deficit is conservative because it doesn't account for the gimmicks they have. And I think what will be very angering to progressives like myself is that we just know as soon as this passes, they'll say, oh, now we have to go after Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid because the debt's going up.
So, Rich, Republicans have stated a number of objectives for tax reform. Some of the biggest ones are that they want to boost the economy, create jobs, relieve middle-class families' taxes. They also want to be responsible in some manner on the budget deficit, but different members seem to mean different things by that. How good a job does this bill do of meeting the various objectives that Republicans have?
Well, it's best on the corporate side, and that's what's really driven this. And in terms of Donald Trump, I mean, the one really legislative goal he set out this year that he's stuck to and seemed to be serious about is getting the corporate rate down from 35%. Not to 25 or 24 or 23 or 22 or 21, but to 20. Made it a matter of theological purity. And I think on the corporate side, it's pretty good. And it will lead to increased economic growth. How much? I don't know. No one knows. I'm just certain it'll be more than $0 worth of increased economic growth and less than $1.5 trillion of economic growth. And one thing that I thought was sort of astonishing about the joint tax score is that some Republicans seemed shocked that the tax cut wouldn't pay for itself. And that's just a talking point that has no basis in reality. All things being equal, a tax cut like this should make up more revenue than it loses on a static basis, but it's never going to pay for itself. So ideally, they would go back and revisit the entitlements that Gene fears. They'll say they want to cut, but the fact is there's very little appetite for that. The president has no appetite for it, and it's going to be very hard to turn around and say, oh, we just cut taxes for ExxonMobil, but by the way, we want to cut your Social Security benefits.
So when Rich says, you know, it's going to cost somewhere between zero and $1.5 trillion, but part of how they got to the $1.5 trillion number is they have all these provisions that expire. Some of them expire after 10 years. Some of them expire even sooner than that. And so you hear conflicting messages from Republicans. One is that, you know, well, this is an accurate measure because the bill says that these things expire. But then the flip side thing you hear from them is, well, you know, obviously this isn't going to be a middle class tax increase because we're going to extend those tax cuts. They will not, in fact, expire. But if they do that, then, of course, it will add more than $1.5 trillion to the debt. And so I guess, Gene, when we look back at the history of tax policy in the U.S., because there have been a lot of these sorts of laws in the past where a provision is intended to be permanent, but for budgetary or other reasons, they make it temporary and then Congress has to come back every few years and decide to extend it. Should people be afraid that this bill is going to mean a tax increase on their families in a few years? Or should they feel pretty confident that Congress will go back, do more deficit spending if necessary in order to extend all these tax cuts?
Yeah, well, you hit it just right. I mean, you know, it's kind of humorous at times, right? I mean, when we point out that this would raise taxes or not give a tax cut to 156 million Americans in 2027, the response seems to be, oh, why are you taking us seriously on our plan? Of course we're lying. Of course we're planning on that actually having a bigger hole in the deficit. I think the reason why middle-income families should and working families should be worried is that you probably are going to have a bigger hole in the deficit, you almost certainly because of the irresponsibility of this tax cut. And this will put enormous pressure to either not extend those tax cuts, as Republicans refuse to extend the tax cuts, the middle class tax cuts that Barack Obama had, make work pay, a payroll tax cut. So they are very capable of not extending a middle class tax cut, or, as I said, getting back to this, you know, lose-lose choice for middle-class families, which is, well, since we decided corporate tax cuts for Exxon are forever, but tax cuts for, you know, hardworking families is a sometime thing. If you want your tax cut to be extended, you know, what do you want to take away in terms of higher education, Medicaid, or Medicare? And I think that's what working families should feel very worried about.
But my big problem with the 2027 number is people cite it without noting that this is when the tax cuts are expiring, as though this is what the bill does in the main, which it's not. There is a big middle-class tax cut prior to that, and the Senate has gone further than the House to ensure that there's a middle-class, at least a tax cut for middle-class families, by doubling the child tax credit.
To Gene's point about entitlements, we've heard mixed messages from Republicans about what this means for entitlements. Marco Rubio was saying that, you know, this is the first step and there's going to have to be entitlement reform. Of course, on the other hand, you have a Republican president who went out there on the campaign trail and said he won't cut Medicare or Social Security because he'll make us so rich you won't have to do that. Do you think Republicans actually see entitlement reform as being something that they're going to take up? Is that something that's likely to actually move through a Republican Congress in the next few years?
There's some in Congress who want to do it, but I can't see it happening in the next 2 years. And I think the Trump administration's attitude is, we've done this, we've kind of nailed down our business base, and next year is going to be about playing to the more populist element of Trump's base, with more than just tweets and culture war controversies, but with some policy through infrastructure, which will involve even more spending, and through a trade war with China.
Gene, one of the things that this Senate bill does that will likely come out in whatever bill that is merged between the Senate version and the House version is that it repeals the individual mandate under Obamacare, the requirement for people to carry insurance. Or technically what it does is it reduces the mandate penalty to be equal to $0. How big an effect do you think that's going to have on the healthcare market, on insurance rates, and on the number of people who carry health insurance?
Well, you know, I think there's no question that it's going to cost coverage by, you know, 10 to 13 million people. I think that's a very negative impact. I think when you don't have any type of requirement, you're going to make those insurance pools less stable. Senator Collins is trying to suggest that she can, you know, get an agreement on Alexander Murray, which is a proposal that was designed to stabilize the individual market more. But Senator Murray herself has been very clear that while her bill is important, it will not prevent spikes, and it will not prevent the 10 to 13 million that are losing. And I think, Josh, and this goes to the point Rich just said, I think that beyond the fact that the tax cuts are sunset, and that's when you get the numbers like 70% of people not getting a tax cut, that even before that, it's very sparse for working families. It really does raise taxes overall, even when all the things are fully implemented. For people making under $30,000, that's somebody working full-time at $14.50 an hour. By 2025, you have tens of millions of people having a tax increase or getting nothing at all. And I think when they look and see the size of this tax cut for the Exxons, for the huge companies, I think even when they look at the whole package, people are going to question whether this is really a plan that is designed for working families. It is all built on the proposition, which I think is a lie, that giving major companies a huge net tax cut is going to increase the wages of workers, something we have not seen happen, even when profits have gone up significantly in the last 20 years.
I think this figure that if the individual mandate is abolished, 10 or 13 million people will drop off of health insurance is totally fantastical. It's a product of a CBO model that apparently the CBO itself is going to revisit. And it's also led to these misleading attacks on the bill that will supposedly raise taxes for people really far down the income scale, which is entirely artifact of the fact that if you drop your health insurance because you no longer feel compelled by government fine to carry it, you no longer get a tax subsidy through Obamacare. And the absence of that tax subsidy is scored by the CBO as a tax increase. I don't think any commonsensical person would agree with that way
well,
of looking
well,
at it.
But there is another issue for sort of the working poor, low-income families, which is that this isn't a provision that raises their taxes, but because the expansion of the child tax credit is not refundable, meaning you only get it if you make enough income that you pay income tax, a lot of those working poor families won't benefit from it. And this is an issue that Marco Rubio and Mike Lee, two conservative Republican senators, had focused on, and their proposal has been, well, let's change the bill. Let's make that refundable at least against the Social Security taxes that these people pay, and pay for that by setting the corporate income tax rate 2 points higher, cutting it to 22 instead of 20. And this is an idea that's gotten very little traction among Republicans. Rich, shouldn't this be something that Republicans are focused on, sort of helping out working families with low incomes who have children?
I think so. I think it makes a lot of sense. But the blowback has been severe. The Wall Street Journal editorial page ran a piece attacking this idea as though Marco Rubio and Mike Lee had proposed nationalizing the banks or something. And it goes to this theological commitment to the 20% corporate rate, which is the tentpole of this bill. And, you know, going from 35 to 22, as Lee and Rubio are talking about, to make some headroom for the revenue loss that would come from this refundable child tax credit, which would work in effect as a kind of payroll tax cut, which I think is a very good idea. It would still be a big cut in the corporate rate, but apparently not enough for some of my friends.
I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review, Gene Sperling of the Obama and Clinton administrations. Up ahead, Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog joins us to talk about Mike Flynn's plea deal. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Gene Sperling, who served in the Obama and Clinton administrations. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And joining us now is our special guest, Susan Hennessy. She's a national security fellow at the Brookings Institution and the managing editor of the Lawfare blog. So, big news Friday morning with former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn pleading guilty to one count of lying to federal investigators. Flynn has admitted that in January he falsely told FBI agents he had not asked Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak to refrain from escalating in response to new sanctions imposed by the outgoing Obama administration. He also admitted he lied about calls he had with representatives of countries on the UN Security Council regarding a resolution related to Israel. Flynn has said publicly that he is cooperating with Mueller's probe. Susan, what should we make of this plea?
Yeah, so there's a ton to unpack here. Sort of one of the most notable things on its face is sort of is how narrow it is, right? So based just on media reports, we know that Flynn has a pretty broad range of possible exposure. Everything from sort of failing to have adequate disclosures on his SF-86 security clearance forms to FARA filings, all the way to sort of recent reports regarding this alleged plot to kidnap a Turkish cleric located in the United States. So really sort of an astonishing range, really. This plea agreement is very much on the lower end of the spectrum. It's just for lying to federal officials. But whenever it says what the plea is related to, right, so what he's sort of off the hook for, it really is a pretty narrow set of conduct, right? He's not going to be held responsible for lying, and he's also not going to be held responsible for these or prosecuted for these FARA violations. That still leaves a lot on the table. And so it does sort of suggest that not only is Flynn cooperating and cooperating in a really significant way, but also that Mueller still has kind of a pretty big hammer if he doesn't feel like Flynn is being adequately forthcoming.
Oh, so that's interesting. So Flynn could conceivably be prosecuted for other things that aren't discussed in this deal. This doesn't constitute a commitment from Mueller to not prosecute Flynn for basically anything so long as Flynn cooperates in the investigation?
Exactly. I mean, so, you know, we're reading the documents that we have, but this, you know, based on the information that was presented today, it leaves open the possibility that we might see another plea agreement and that this is not sort of the full range. You know, fundamentally, look, this is a really sweet deal for somebody who's in the position that Flynn is in. If even kind of a modicum, a tenth of what is has been alleged about him is true and provable, you know, this is his defense attorneys have really earned their salaries. So, you know, Flynn, based on this deal, will face about 6 months in prison, like a $10,000 fine. So that suggests that Mueller is getting substantial cooperation from Flynn, and he's really letting him off the hook, which probably indicates that there's somebody higher up on the chain and a lot of information related to somebody higher up on the chain. When you're talking about the former National Security Advisor, the group of individuals that might be more attractive to a prosecutor than that person, especially on sort of a public corruption, public integrity type case, that's a very, very limited group, and it's a group that's got to be pretty close to the president himself.
Should we read anything into the fact that the whole statement of offense from Flynn relates to conduct that occurred after last year's election? The conversations that Flynn lied to federal investigators about were all conversations that occurred during the transition after Trump had already been elected president. It's not about, say, pre-election dealings between the Trump campaign and the Russians. Should we read anything into the idea that maybe Mueller is focused on stuff after the election and is not so focused on possible collusion prior to the election?
I don't know how much we can read into sort of the scope of Mueller's inquiry as opposed to just the scope of what's easily provable against Flynn. And to the extent that it is focused on that transition period and the period of time in which Flynn is in office, I actually think that's probably worse news story for the Trump administration, right? You can get away with a lot or with more as sort of a private citizen than you can whenever you're, you know, a public official or a quasi-public official. And so I think to sort of put this stuff in context, we really have to take ourselves back to, okay, what was happening in the end of December 2016? The Obama administration had imposed these sanctions with broad bipartisan support. There was actually a lot of criticism from the GOP saying that Obama hadn't gone far enough in order to counter essentially future Russian interference in our elections and in our allies' elections, right? So this was a policy, the foreign policy of the United States that had kind of cross-spectrum support. What is being alleged here is Flynn, you know, allegedly at the direction of other senior Trump officials, essentially working with the Russians against sort of the consensus U.S. foreign policy position. So I actually think that the fact that this is closer to the period of the actual administration, the period of official duties, that actually strikes me as potentially an even worse story for this administration. Once you add in kind of the compounding issues of misrepresentations to the American public, then I really do think that this could be incredibly problematic for Trump for a really significant period of time.
Rich, at least in theory, Vice President Mike Pence was in charge of the Trump transition. And this complaint describes a lot of activity by the transition and senior transition officials. And I guess it's theoretically possible that Mike Pence did not know what Mike Flynn was up to, which has been the administration's claim. Because remember, the reason officially that Mike Flynn was fired from his job as national security advisor was that he had lied to the vice president about these calls. So the best story for them is that the vice president knew very little about what the transition he was running was doing. What does this story mean for the administration?
Well, I think that's correct that Pence didn't know much. I remember at the time, you know, had conservative cabinet appointments and some of us on the outside, wow, it just really shows how Mike Pence is running things in effect. And I had a friend who sat down with Mike Pence and was like, no, he's depressed and out of the loop. So, and I think he's probably out of the loop on this stuff. Look, I take Susan's point that Mueller still might be dropping more on Flynn. But I think it's notable this is a process offense. And if there were some broader conspiracy that he had evidence of, he would be charged or taking a plea for his participation in said conspiracy rather than lying to the FBI. Now, lying to the FBI is a terrible thing to do. He shouldn't have done it. If he did it solely on the basis of a theoretical violation of the Logan Act, which says a private citizen can't interfere with conduct of U.S. foreign policy, he's an idiot because there's no way he would have gotten prosecuted on that. And he just should have said, you know, come and get me, copper, if you're going to get me as the incoming national security advisor to the incoming United States government talking to the Russians and not undermining U.S. foreign policy, just telling the Russians not to retaliate against our sanctions. I don't see how it's an important foreign policy goal of the United States to have the Russians retaliate against us. But he lied. And it makes you wonder who else lied. You know, did any of these figures in the transition who were working with him on this or ordering him to do this, had they talked to Mueller? Have they also lied? And we're basically, I think, still in the same place. We have a lot of strange behavior from Trump not criticizing Russia, now to people lying under oath. And is the underlying cause of that strange behavior just that they're of low character and dishonest, which is the relatively exculpatory explanation, or are they lying because there's something much worse?
Gene, what have you made of this news?
Well, I agree with the view that when you have something this narrow, that doesn't lead you to the optimistic interpretation of White House counsel Ty Cobb or Rich. It makes you think this person got a fairly sweet, narrow deal. They must have a lot to say. That's my first thought. The second is, and I think this is very important, there are times people lie to the FBI on a personal matter that they are engaged, that they are embarrassed about, their taxes, having an affair, something like that. And that's kind of bad for the individual, but it's not central. This is a lie that is about the centrality of how Jared Kushner, Donald Trump, Mike Flynn work together on the number one issue, which is what was their dealing with Russia. And this obviously could bring in Jared Flynn. It obviously could bring in the president. And then let's remember, this is only a part of the story. This story continues with Sally Yates coming to the White House and say, Michael Flynn is compromised. And then it goes to the president of the United States having a private dinner with the FBI director and asking him to drop the investigation. I think when you look at the context here, this should be very, very troubling for the Trump White House.
Susan, when we look at this context during the transition, and if the story about what the Trump transition officials were up to is that basically they were talking with the Russians, and the complaint also describes that they were talking with representatives of other countries on the UN Security Council. They were the official story, I assume, would be that they were doing it in order to conduct foreign policy, that they wanted Russia not to escalate this sanctions war. They wanted the UN Security Council to treat this resolution in a certain way. And that might violate various norms about how actively a transition should involve itself in the foreign policy of a country that it is about to run, but that it doesn't run yet. But it seems to me like that's not necessarily illegal, right? The underlying activity here of having these contacts with the Russians in order to achieve certain policy outcomes seems like it would not necessarily be a crime, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I agree with Rich, the notion that this is sort of a violation of the Logan Act. You know, it's never the Logan Act, and to the extent, you know, that we're talking
about Logan Act, for those who don't know, is an over 200-year-old law against private citizens conducting foreign policy under which the federal government has never in its entire history received a conviction.
You know, that said, this is different than just the incoming administration having a different set of foreign policy goals than the current administration. And we know that the Trump administration or the Trump transition team understood how inappropriate these contacts were and this behavior was because they then lie about it, right? So they allow Mike Pence to go out. Mike Pence might not have known, but certainly Flynn, and now we know from this information and indictment, some other number of Trump administration officials understood that Mike Pence was going out and lying to the American public. Then press secretary Sean Spicer came out. Oh, no, no. It was a single phone call. It was to say Merry Christmas. It was condolences. No sanctions were discussed, right? So I think sort of the evidence or the thing that puts the lie to this question of, well, you know, they just had different foreign policy goals and there was no issue here, you know, what puts the lie to that is they try and conceal it through the early days of their administration including to making false statements to the FBI themselves. And so I don't, there's sort of this explanation of there was nothing really wrong with the underlying conduct. I just don't think that holds water. You know, the other question here is now that we have this information and we go back and we look at this timeline that Gene was describing that's sort of not relevant to the Russian collusion investigation or that particular story, but to the obstruction of justice investigation or the course of conduct that culminates in the firing of a former FBI director, Jim Comey, you have to ask yourself, you know, how does this information or the possibility that Trump or his inner circle really was intimately involved from the beginning, personally involved from the beginning, how does that color how we should understand, you know, these really questionable kind of interactions where it's difficult to say if there was an obstructive intent? I think now it is possible to go back and say, you know, now knowing what the president knew or probably knew, you know, these things actually are looking worse and worse over time. And you have to wonder what else Mueller knows.
I'm trying to think, Rich, about how we could understand the events of this February in the most exculpatory way possible to Trump. Because I'm thinking about, you know, the vice president goes on television and says that Mike Flynn did not discuss sanctions with the Russians. And what this plea agreement says is not just that Mike Flynn did so, but that some senior official of the transition directed him to do so. So it can't be the case that Mike Flynn was out there freelancing, didn't tell anybody, and that's why Mike Pence didn't know. There was more than one person. If Mike Pence really didn't know what was up, there's more than one person who kept the information from him. It was Mike Flynn and some other senior official of the transition. It seems like, and then this leads to Mike Flynn's firing. They really, it seems like, why did they fire Mike Flynn if this was no big deal? There has to have been some, it feels like they have to have known that they were doing something very wrong, given that they fired the national security advisor, who was very personally close to the president, less than a month into the presidency.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, look, it's people lie in Washington very often just because it's inconvenient. And it might be inconvenient just because the next day's headlines would be quite explosive and you just don't want to deal with it. And at that moment, you know, Russia was a very tender topic as it remains today. And Mike Flynn just would have thought, I just don't want to deal with the headline if the truth comes out. So I'm going to try to cover my tracks and lie about it. Or it
to
could
an
be,
FBI agent.
Right. I mean, it's really stupid. Or it could be much worse. And this gets to Trump and obstruction. If it's just like, you know, he tells Comey, oh, give Mike a break because he's a good guy. And what he really thinks is that he should give Mike a break because he's a good guy. That's not obstruction of justice. It goes to the underlying facts. Was there a deeply corrupt intent to all this? And that's what still none of us know.
Susan, what's the next development you're looking for here? What, now that Flynn is cooperating, what should we expect to happen?
Well, certainly, I think that the person who's going to face the next round of scrutiny is likely Jared Kushner. So there are already sort of early media reports that the very senior official who allegedly directed Flynn to have contacts with the Russians regarding this UN vote was Kushner personally. We know that Kushner sat down with Special Counsel Mueller's team sometime in the past week or so. So what statements did Kushner make to Mueller's team, and were they consistent with what the facts that Flynn is prepared to testify to, and sort of what is the nature of his conduct and involvement? You know, certainly Mike Flynn has a pretty substantial story to tell. He's been saying that from the beginning. He's been saying he hopes he has a chance to tell it. You know, Mueller has up to this point run a pretty tight ship in terms of not being a ton of leaks that seem to be coming out of his particular camp. But I think that we're, you know, as Rich noted, you know, there's still a lot of information we just don't know here. And this investigation is going along, you know, kind of 20 different tracks at the same time. You know, the other thing that we see is that the special counsel investigation will take a giant leap forward. They'll have an indictment. They'll sort of hit a new milestone, and then it'll go quiet for a while. All of a sudden, you know, the congressional investigations, the HPSI and SSCI investigations, those will really heat up as they're getting new information from the special counsel, and they're putting all the pieces together. So I also think we have to keep in mind that, you know, the Trump team isn't just kind of fighting off Mueller on one flank. They also have this sprawling set of congressional investigations going on at the same time, which also might put them in jeopardy, especially to the extent they've made representations that are not consistent with what people are now telling the special counsel and under oath.
Gene, there's been some controversy among Democrats. Tom Steyer, this hedge fund billionaire in California, has been running this ad campaign to impeach the president. You see some members of Congress calling for that, others saying, no, that's premature and or politically unwise. When is the right time, if any, for Democrats to start saying, you know, what's coming out of here is something that Congress needs to act on?
Well, I think Democrats have a very strong point to make that you should think about voting for them in 2018 because you need a check on power and that you need to have, a full investigation. Nobody is less of a fan of Donald Trump than myself. But I do believe in process, and I think the most important thing right now for Democrats to be pushing is a fair, open, process, nobody intervening with Mueller, that the Republicans on the House and Senate Intelligence Committees act like independent investigators and not partisans. I think that's the right place to be, and, that's where I think we should be right now, and if the evidence comes out that there is a clearly impeachable event from this, they should do so. But I think that there's nothing wrong right now with staying to let's have a fair investigation with no political interference, either in the House and Senate Intelligence Committee or in Mueller's investigation.
I've been talking with Rich Lowry of National Review, Gene Sperling of the Obama and Clinton administrations, and Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog. We'll be back with Conflicts Overseas and Alyssa Rosenberg on Matt Lauer. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Gene Sperling of the Obama and Clinton administrations. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog is also with us. So the Flynn plea deal comes at a time of other significant turmoil in and around the White House. The president retweeted anti-Muslim propaganda videos from a far-right English political activist, an action that drew him a rebuke from Prime Minister Theresa May. He then basically told her to back off on Twitter. He even got a mild rebuke from Nigel Farage, the right-wing English political leader who isn't quite as right-wing as this woman, Jada Franson, who he retweeted. He was also rebuked by Celebrity Apprentice winner Piers Morgan. The president hasn't apologized. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says the terrorist threat is real, even if the videos aren't. North Korea launched its most impressive missile yet, leading Trump to lament that Chinese pressure on North Korea doesn't seem to be working. There was a torrent of leaks from the White House suggesting that Trump is looking at firing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to replace him with CIA Director Mike Pompeo, and then that Mike Pompeo would be replaced at the CIA with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, although we have a late-breaking tweet from the president saying that it is fake news that he is thinking about Tillerson, that Tillerson is not leaving, and that while they disagree on certain subjects where the president calls the final shots, they work well together, and America is highly respected again. So I guess Rex Tillerson's job is safe for the next few hours. And then finally, the New York Times reports the president has been telling people that he doesn't think the Access Hollywood tape is authentic and that he never should have said that Barack Obama was born in the United States. And so Maggie Haberman, who's the New York Times White House correspondent, probably like the leading White House reporter in this administration, was saying earlier this week that she's known Trump for a really long time, going back to when she was a reporter at the New York tabloids covering him here as a non-politician. And that his behavior has become different in the last few weeks, that this is unusual even for him. Rich, do you have a sense, is the president losing it right now?
Well, Maggie knows him much better than I do and actually deals with him or talks to people very close to him on an hourly basis, but I just don't see it. I don't think anything we've seen has been particularly surprising or would have shocked me 2 years ago. There are some people who say, oh, look at his statements. They're rambling and incoherent, and the end has no connection to the beginning. But that's always been true as far as I can tell. And he's always had a penchant for conspiracy theories. So this is what the country signed up for.
Gene, what did you make of this week's performance?
Pure Trump. One, he acts, whether he's guilty or not, he acts more guilty than any person I've ever seen, particularly with anything doing with Russia. Two, when you can almost kind of tell when bad news is coming, because he will use his Twitter account to do things that are outrageous and usually racially divisive, and I think often preemptive. And I was even struck by the idea that he now wanted to kind of discredit the idea that when you hear his voice, it's necessarily his voice. So I don't think it's a great compliment that that Rich doesn't find any of the actions surprising or out of character. I guess I'm probably in the same place, but it does make me think that he is worried and he is scared, and it's exacerbating his bad behavior.
I don't buy that at all. This is sort of the distraction theory that he does this to take people's attention away from bad news or looming stories. He does this all the time in any circumstance. This week he had good news. You know, the Senate was on the verge of passing his tax bill. He won this legal fight over control of the Consumer Financial Protection Board, and he distracted from that. And I think it's fundamentally because he obviously can't help himself, but he likes stirring the pot. He likes being in the center of attention. And a lot of this, I think, is just to entertain himself. He doesn't want to be bored, and he likes venting his frustrations. He finds it extremely psychically gratifying to tweet out these messages, so he does it, and it's not any more complicated or sophisticated than that.
Well, Susan?
Yeah, so, look, I don't know why he does it, and I tend to agree that it seems more in keeping with his prior conduct than a huge break. I will say that this week we are seeing how we all bear the consequences of that, right? So just take sort of tweeting these, anti-Muslim videos. Look, it's a real achievement to alienate the United States' closest ally in a way that is going to have, potentially significant consequences for that relationship, our intelligence-sharing relationships. These are really, really important foundational agreements and relationships that we have. The notion that the State Department had to issue a warning to its embassies around the world, to potentially be prepared for some forms of violence in response to this. So I think what we're really feeling this week is maybe not a change in how sort of Trump is acting, but yet another sort of realization about the extent to which his mercurial and bizarre conduct really has pretty profound consequences for Americans and for the United States of America.
What do we make of this public hazing of Rex Tillerson? It seems very similar to what we went through with Jeff Sessions a couple of months ago, where the White House sort of put out these very public suggestions that Jeff Sessions might get fired, but didn't actually do it. And Jeff Sessions didn't resign if it was their attempt to make him do so. And sort of, and then it just stayed where it was.
Yeah, someone pointed out to me at the time, Tillerson was an unorthodox choice for this position, and more unorthodox than a lot of the other cabinet positions. And someone pointed out to me at the time, Donald Trump just loves having the CEO of Exxon working for him in a fireable position. So I think he, enjoys the element of humiliation that Tillerson's going through and will enjoy firing him, not personally because he doesn't like personal confrontation himself, but will enjoy him being ousted when the time comes. And the time will come. It might not be, next week or the week after, but in the next few months, it'll happen. This has been a disastrous tenure for Rex Tillerson at State. He does not fill the stage at all. He's loomed small in this job. The State Department itself has been kind of pointlessly hollowed out and beleaguered and is not in the least bit a tool of Trump's foreign policy the way it should be. He has no relationship with the press, with Capitol Hill, or with the president himself. So this is not he's not long for this world in that position.
I have been talking with Susan Hennessy of the Lawfare blog, Gene Sperling, formerly of the Obama and Clinton administrations, and Rich Lowry of National Review. Another week has brought another round of sex harassment stories. Garrison Keillor, creator of A Prairie Home Companion, was fired from Minnesota Public Radio. More members of Congress are calling for senior Democrat John Conyers to resign from the House over his sex harassment scandals. And Politico is reporting that only one sex harassment settlement has been paid out of that secret congressional settlement fund since 2013. It was for Blake Farenthold, a Republican from Texas. But the biggest news this week is Matt Lauer, fired from NBC's Today Show. With Lauer joining Charlie Rose, that means two of the three big morning news shows have lost male hosts under the clouds of pretty seedy sex harassment allegations in the last couple of weeks. This is where I should note that I also work for NBC News. To discuss these stories, we're going to bring in a new guest. Alyssa Rosenberg blogs about popular culture for the Washington Post opinion section. Alyssa, what do you take out of this week's sex harassment news?
Well, I know you said earlier in the program that we're going to talk about sexual harassment in morning television in Congress, and the truth is it feels like we're talking about sexual harassment everywhere, right? It's omnipresent, it's exhausting, and I think in Lauer's case, it was shocking to a lot of people because he has this, he's one of America's dads, right? He's, you know, he's handsome, he's on a morning show, so he's supposed to be sort of non-threatening, he's well-dressed, et cetera. And the things that he's accused of doing are, as in all of these cases, are just so gross. I mean, you know, sending a sex toy to a coworker and talking about how he wanted to use it on her, exposing himself. You know, he has this sort of Bond-like button on his desk that he can use to close the door from the inside and prevent anyone from walking in on him. And so I think that these sort of fresh waves of disgust keep coming at us all of the time from so many different directions. They're heightened by, in some cases, by the juxtaposition with someone's supposed reputation. At the same time, I think to a certain extent, it's really good that we're still able to feel the full force of that visceral disgust instead of getting burned out. It's been a long 2 months. There are a lot of these stories. They're all, as you say, seedy, in some cases outright disgusting. So the fact that we can still get mad at this, I think, actually strikes me as healthy for this cultural reckoning.
I think one reason the morning TV stuff hits people so much is that these are shows that are basically designed for women. The audience for the shows is heavily female. And so it seems like a remarkable juxtaposition that this is a product that sort of should be centered around women. And yet we've had two of the three big ones having these cultures that seem to have tolerated this harassment that was known about not necessarily by everyone, but by a reasonable number of people around these hosts.
Well, and I think jumping off from that, you know, you see with Lauer, you know, Ann Curry gets let go from the show. He stays on. And it's also not just that these shows are aimed at women. It's that they're in your home in the morning, right? These hosts are supposed to be sort of part of your family to a certain extent. So these are cultural figures who people are accustomed to spending an enormous amount of time with. Harvey Weinstein may have made a lot of movies that you like, that you may have seen him on stage at the Oscars, you may have heard him get thanked, but it's not as if you were sitting down to your morning coffee with Harvey Weinstein every morning. You know, he wasn't supposed to be this fuzzy, safe figure. And so for that violation to come into people's living rooms, I think is particularly visceral.
Gene, what have you made of the sort of slower reaction in political spaces than in business spaces, where basically you've seen a lot of these stories come out about either executives or television figures, and they seem to get fired fairly quickly, whereas in Congress, you've had this very slow reaction about John Conyers. This week, Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats have been saying that he should resign, but it took a while for them to get there. People are still figuring out within Congress how they feel about Al Franken. Is it a problem about government that government bodies don't seem to be holding their members to account in the same way that private organizations are?
You know, I think this is raising kind of a larger issue, which is this is a tremendously positive moment in our country, a watershed moment. I mean, it is amazing to see the kind of epidemic of hostile work environments with sex harassment and the deterrence from the degree of punishment that people like Harvey Weinstein and others are receiving is going to have a positive effect for a long time. I think, though, as we go forward, we're going to have to figure out how we have processes that make sure the people who are raising these things are given, you know, even when they're not in celebrity and news situations, are given a very quick way of seeking justice without stigmatization, without a potential retaliation. But I also think we have to do the swiftness for those who are accused so that, you know, there is a process where people believe will move quickly to resolve the issue. And I think when you have elected officials where the public's put them in there, you probably do need to take that into account. But I think it needs to move very, very more swift so that people have a sense that if it's not happening right away, it's not because they're getting a better deal. It's just because a understood process that's fair to the accused and the accuser is running out in swift fashion. And if the person's guilty, that there will be a swift punishment.
Rich, there's been this strong public desire to know what settlements have been paid out in Congress related to sexual harassment. And there have been a lot of coverage around this settlement fund that's specifically created to pay out settlements. But it turns out that at least in the last few years, there's just this one settlement that got paid out of it in the House, which is for this guy, Blake Farenthold, which he's a former radio host who had been famously pictured in very silly pajamas standing next to a scantily clad woman. If you Google Blake Farenthold pajamas, you'll see a photo that maybe you don't really want to see. So he's not the most surprising figure here. But then you had John Conyers, who paid a settlement out of his own office budget, basically structured it as a severance to an employee. There's another member of Congress, Al Green, who's reported to have done the same thing. So it seems like people ought to know whether people are using the money that's supposed to be for staff salaries, in fact, to pay out settlements that are then undisclosed to the public about various kinds of bad behavior in congressional offices. But it's not clear how we can learn about that.
Yeah. So this slush fund, so-called, is a little misnamed. I mean, it was a slush fund for any sort of employment actions, not necessarily related to sexual harassment, and not necessarily having to do anything with a member of Congress, him or herself. It covers staffers as well. And now there's legislation moving forward to kind of update all of this. And I'd hope there'd be a way to achieve transparency in all of these cases. But sometimes, you know, the accuser might want to keep it confidential for her own reasons. Just a couple thoughts on Matt Lauer. It seems more of the same. Powerful man hideously abuses his authority, and his victims are afraid to blow the whistle on it. But a couple things brought home to me. One, it just seems as though the HR departments at large organizations, including many media organizations, must be completely worthless that you can have this guy sexually assaulting people and nothing comes of it. Two, I just don't buy. We've heard over and over again from people who've written books with or appeared on TV every day for years with someone saying they had no idea. And I just don't buy that at all. I don't watch any morning shows on broadcast, at least. I know nothing about Matt Lauer, but I'd heard weeks ago that, something was coming down on Matt Lauer, and I just can't believe that everyone at NBC, from, the top executives to the fellow on-air talent, was really as shocked about this as they pretended to be.
Listen, we were talking before the show about sort of the role that large organizations play in protecting their employees that they view as particularly high-value employees when they know that they have problems of these sorts.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Harvey Weinstein's contract with the Weinstein Company, he re-upped with them in 2015, and there is literally language in his contract that says that he has to reimburse the company for any, settlements or judgments made against it as a result of his violations of the code of conduct. And he also has to pay a series of escalating fines for each such incident. And so, this is a situation where if you have someone who is serially committing sexual wrongs, why are you structuring it financially into his contract to minimize the harm to yourself instead of firing him, right? I mean, you look at the culture at Fox News for so long, which involved protecting not just top talent, but the chairman of the company. And part of what is striking to me about this is the dollar figures involved in everything, right? I mean, the Weinstein Company thinks, okay, theoretically, maybe $1 million fine per incident will stop Harvey Weinstein from behaving badly. You look at Bill O'Reilly, who's paying a $32 million sexual harassment settlement in order to preserve his position in contract negotiations. These are staggering amounts of money. They don't necessarily seem to be enough to have radically changed the culture at these organizations or by these individuals before these revelations. And, it's an illustration of just how valuable some of these men are, right? That financial consequences that seem staggering to most of us don't seem to have been enough to change the culture.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
James O'Keefe runs a conservative guerrilla video operation that seeks to expose corruption in left-wing organizations, and he's had some big successes in the past. He basically shut down the left-wing organization Acorn, but he was embarrassed last week when his attempt to basically entrap the Washington Post into reporting a false allegation about Roy Moore was exposed, because the Post actually did the legwork and enough reporting to smell a rat and trace this supposed accuser back to James O'Keefe. It pains me to say this, but this was a contest between a liberal outlet with standards versus a conservative outlet with none.
Gene Sperling, what's your rant?
Right before we came on the air, Senator Claire McCaskill posted a list of special interest provisions that just got into the Senate bill with nobody seeing them in the dark of night. You already had a tax bill that had started with a major corporate tax cut, a large estate tax cut. You know, people were celebrating the 25th anniversary of Bill Clinton's campaign on putting people first. When you look at these special interest provisions coming in at the last moment, you have to ask yourself, who are they putting first?
Susan Hennessy, what's on your mind?
So my rant is more notes on the theme of Rex Tillerson. So Condoleezza Rice and Bob Gates were absolutely critical in pushing Tillerson's confirmation as Secretary of State. You know, they both personally vouched for him and really, really essential to that decision. You know, by all accounts, Tillerson has been a disaster, and it's complete crickets from these two. So I am begging some enterprising reporter to go out and ask Gates and Rice if they still stand by their man.
Well, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Gene Sperling, Susan Hennessy, and Alyssa Rosenberg. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.